Hello, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're going to take a look at the crisis in South Sudan. If you've had a hard time placing the world's newest country on a map or have no idea, really, what the issues there are, you're not alone. As is often the case, African news rarely gets much coverage in the U.S., but we're going to try and do our part today to remedy that at least a bit. Our guest is Joke Madu-Joke. He is a professor in the Department of History at Loyola Marymount University in California. He's a native of South Sudan, and he was formerly undersecretary in the Ministry of Culture and Heritage for that country. He joins us by phone today. Joke, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, ma'am, for having me.
Well, it's really good to have you as a resource to find out what's going on in South Sudan. And I want to let our listeners know that they can join in the conversation as well. We're broadcasting out of our Madison studios today, so the number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Again, 800-642-1234. You can also email questions and comments to talk@wpr.org or post them on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Joke, maybe you can start out because, as I said, and I'm sure it's no surprise to you, African news really doesn't get as much coverage in the U.S. media as it deserves. Tell us a little bit about the history of Sudan and then South Sudan in the 20th century.
Okay, thank you. A lot of historians will quibble about the creation of Sudan out of a multitude of ethnic, racial, and religious groupings that was started in 1821 by the Ottoman Turkey through Egypt, and later on colonized by Sudan. And I mean by Britain, and it was Great Britain that really formed the current boundaries of what has now become two Sudans. South Sudan found itself different from North Sudan, and therefore, shortly before independence in 1956, there was a war in the South to try to reject the idea of independence from Britain, only for South Sudan to fall into colonization by the North, a kind of Arab colonization, a transition from British colonization to Arab colonization. So South Sudan objecting to such a transition started a war that lasted 17 years. The goal of that war was for South Sudan to become independent. But a peace agreement was signed to try to get the two sides to give peace and unity a chance, hoping that the leaders in Khartoum would resolve some of the grievances that South Sudanese had in order for the two sides to remain in unity. This was not done, and so in 1983, the war began again from the South, and this lasted now over 20 years, and that war ended in 2005 with an agreement that enabled the people of South Sudan to vote in a referendum in 2011 to become independent from Sudan. And so the new country, the world's newest nation, was born on July 9th, 2011. And to the expectations and euphoria and so much promise from the people of South Sudan that now that the colonial master has departed, that things will be rosy once again. People will be secure. People will be able to exercise democracy in their independent country. That people will be able to rebuild what that those wars of liberation had destroyed. And so, when the situation blew up on December 15th, 2013, just before Christmas, it came as both a shock and a surprise to some people. But a lot of people say that this was not surprising at all, because what had been promised to the people of South Sudan as a result of their independence was not done. One of these things that was not done was to repair the ethnic relations that had been destroyed.
And let's talk about those ethnic groups that are make up the population of South Sudan. And also, going back to something you said about North Sudan, you referred to the Arab population. But for people that aren't familiar with it, that's actually more of a cultural identification, isn't it, for the Muslim people in North Sudan?
Yes, it is both. It is a cultural in Sudan, in what has now remained as the Republic of Sudan after the independence of South Sudan. You still have a great deal of diversity, racial and ethnic and religious and ethnic. The people who live in the central riverine region of that country who have become Arabized, yes, are a mix of Arab culturally, as well as Arab linguistically. And then when you add in the element of religion, which some people seem to believe to be a global religion that originated from the Arabs, there is a mindset in the Republic of Sudan among some very devout Muslims who think that Islam and Arabic are intertwined to make Sudan categorically an Arab country. But yes, you're right. It is more of an Arabized culture rather than purely Arab, as you would see in Egypt or in Lebanon or any other Middle Eastern country.
So what are the tribal affiliations predominantly in South Sudan? And
in South Sudan, there is close to 70 ethnic groups, 70 ethnic groups. The biggest are the Dinka, followed by the Nuer, and several other big entities, nationalities like the Zande, like the Bari in central Equatoria. South Sudan is a very, very extremely diverse country, unlike many other African countries, but also slightly different in that regard, in the sense that there is just a lot of the of different ethnic groups. So the challenge of for a new independent country was now to try to build a sense of collective national identity so that all these various groups begin to express citizenship in the nation and less so in their tribe, so that South Sudan, if you will, becomes a kind of their tribe for everyone. Mm-hmm. But this requires a lot of effort. It requires money, it requires conversation, it requires all these ethnic groups that had sometimes turned guns against each other during the liberation war. Even as they were fighting the North, there have been episodes whereby some ethnic groups have turned guns against one another. But these were all patched up or swept under the rug in the hope that when the independence come, people would be able to revisit these and say these were done under the weight of a war, a vicious war with the North. But now that South Sudan has become independent, maybe there is a way for us to sit down and say, let us chart a different path for ourselves.
We are talking with Jok Madujok. He is professor in the Department of History at Loyola Marymount University in California. He's a native of South Sudan and a co-founder of the think tank, the Sud Institute. And we would welcome your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's the Madison phone number today. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. We would love to have you join the conversation with your questions or comments. And Joke, you were talking about how, you know, this striving for a sense of unity. I think it's not an uncommon phenomenon that when there's a common enemy or a common cause that different groups are fighting towards, there's a sense of unity. But then when that goal is achieved, then those pretty deep cracks in the unity are much more visible. Do you feel like that's happened in South Sudan?
Yes, without a doubt. It is not that people really forget the differences that exist during the war. It is simply that people are preoccupied with the common cause. So whatever ethnic group you belong to, all South Sudanese will agree without any shred of doubt that the main goal of that struggle was to get South Sudan to become independent. So whatever differences that existed during that time would simply be patched over in the interest of keeping the eyes on the prize, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And the prize was to get South Sudan to become independent. Now, once independence is achieved, there are two things that happen. One is that the state, the new state, is contested in order for people to get a share of the pie once the state is independent. And that pie comes in the form of government jobs, development projects, contracts, and recognition of each one on a national stage, recognition of all the different nationalities of the country to be, for their culture to be celebrated equitably on a national stage through museums, archives, history, and celebration in the media and so forth. So when the state becomes contested, then of course people lose sight of what used to unite, and they now focus on some of the differences that must be recognized. The second thing that happens when independence comes is that the expectations are very high. Expectations to rebuild what was destroyed in the war, expectations for all the participants in the war to get recognition and get compensated. All of these expectations far outweigh the country's ability to respond, at least in that short time. So now, once independence was achieved in 2011, every ethnic group, every political entity, every region felt that there has to be equitable sharing of resources so that everybody gets a reward for their contribution to the liberation. Now, if that is not done in a very diverse country like this, many small groups will feel that the big dominant ones like the Dinka and the Nuer are taking the biggest share of the pie and exercising the sort of majoritarian tyranny over the smaller groups. And so the current crises in South Sudan are partly born of the feeling of exclusion, particularly among young people. South Sudan is a very youthful country. Over 70% of its population are below the age of 30.
Wow.
And so, and these are people who have spent 20 years, an entire generation of people who have not had a chance to go to school, to invest in themselves, to learn any skills. And now when the country becomes independent, how do you engage all these young people? And if you fail to engage them, to give them a future to live for, their gravitation towards violence becomes unmistakable.
We'll talk more with Jok Madu Jok about how to engage those young South Sudanese and the current crisis that is facing the world's newest country. We'd enjoy having you join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. Right now, we are talking with Jok Madu Jok. He is professor in the Department of History at Loyola Marymount University in California, a native of South Sudan, and a co-founder of the think tank, the Sud Institute. And Jok, thanks again for spending time with us today.
Thank you very much for having me, ma'am.
So South Sudan has some of the worst poverty and health indicators in the world, but there are also a lot of natural resources there. What are the natural resources that might provide some hope for South Sudan building its economy?
Well, at the moment, there is a kind of drunkenness with oil. South Sudan is one of Africa's biggest producers of fossil fuels. And the over 98% of government revenue derived from oil. And this has caused serious problems. It means that those young people I was talking about cannot be employed because oil industry doesn't employ a lot of people. That's just the nature of oil. The second biggest resource and more sustainable, something that I think more of the oil money should be invested in, is agriculture. South Sudan has some of the best and most fertile soil, adequate rainfall, many rivers, and yet South Sudan still imports most of its food from East Africa. And that is just a result of lack of foresight to invest as much as possible in agriculture, in livestock. South Sudan has Africa's largest concentration of cattle. There are more cattle in South Sudan than human beings. And yet, South Sudanese children are still drinking powdered milk from East Africa. And so it is not a lack of resources. South Sudan is a very rich country when it comes to resources. It is a question of how to efficiently utilize these resources. So instead of looking and concentrating on oil as the biggest resource, for the moment I see why that is the case. But it is important for the government and donor community to insist on investing the biggest chunk of that oil money in big capital projects, in doing infrastructure like roads, which would bring in the capacity of remote farmers to send their goods to markets. And it would also facilitate security, because right now, even if a community calls out for support against a kind of insecurity, it is very hard to get the security forces to respond in an efficient manner because there are no roads. So the current crisis in South Sudan is one of a feeling among a lot of people, including most particularly young people and women, from being excluded from the gains of independence, because the concentration of effort on oil means that you can only employ so many people in an oil industry. Mm-hmm. But if you invest the oil money in road construction, in service delivery, in agriculture, in generating electricity, you would employ up to 3 million people. So 80% of those youth would be employed in no time if you engage in those projects. And when there has been a great deal of investment in young people, there is no better way to bring peace than to give everyone a feeling that they have a future to live for, mm-hmm. and they have a lot to lose if they go into any war. But if they have nothing to lose besides their own lives, it is very difficult to contain violence in a country that has only known violence for so long.
Joke, part of the issue with the oil revenues as well is that part of the agreement with Sudan, North Sudan compared to South Sudan, at the time of South Sudan's independence meant also a sharing of those revenues as well, correct?
Yes. Yes. With the situation is that South Sudan produces oil, but South Sudan is also landlocked, so it does not have access to a seaport in order to export its oil. So it has to go through the Republic of Sudan, the very country from which South Sudan seceded. And in order for South Sudan to export that oil, they have to agree with the Republic of Sudan. Part of the agreement involves South Sudan paying a very exorbitant fee for oil facilities which are concentrated in Sudan, and for oil export at the marine terminal in Port Sudan on the Red Sea. So that reduces the income from oil, but still it still means that South Sudan receives very substantial sums from oil. So it is not a question of Sudan taking much of the income. It is a question of what remains with South Sudan being invested efficiently.
We have quite a few people who want to join the conversation, Joke, so let's go to the phones and go to Jean in Madison. Hi, Jean.
Yes. Given that the lines in Africa were drawn up by the Council of Berlin in 1878, and given in my adult life, I remember Biafra, I remember Eritrea, Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, Katanga, I could go on, and of course, Biafra was about oil, and South Sudan is about oil. I'm glad you mentioned it. But what is not discussed is, given there were at least 300 to 500 separate ethnic groups, and how many languages is I don't know. There, the way the lines are drawn in Africa make no sense, especially when you have the religious divides that occur. And why do you think, sir, this never is addressed by anyone?
Thanks for that call, Gene. And Joke, what do you think that the idea of redrawing boundaries to better reflect the reality makes sense?
Well, it does make sense in a number of countries. Let's face it, if you had thousands and thousands of ethnic nationalities in Africa, and at the time of independence in the 1960s, all across the continent, the African leaders who took the helms of power at that time from the Europeans confronted that question. Should we dismantle the colonial boundaries and return to Africa to where it used to be, where every single ethnic group was a nation unto itself? Or do we maintain the colonial boundaries? And the answer was that, yes, we have to maintain the colonial boundaries, with the exceptions of some areas that are very, very difficult to work out, such as South Sudan, such as Eritrea, such as Western Sahara next to Morocco. And these countries have now gained their independence. So the question is not longer about whether colonial boundaries were a good thing or a bad thing. We know full well that they were a bad thing, but that history had taken its course and it was very difficult to return Africa to where it used to be before colonial days. Now, the question is within independent countries themselves, what are some of the policies that they can put in place to make sure that ethnicity comes second to nationalism in the nation? And so in the case of South Sudan, as I was saying earlier, the task upon the leaders of South Sudan since 2011 was to give every citizen a sense that they have a stake in that nation and that this nation is a stronger, united rather than divided along ethnic lines. And I can assure you that not a single South Sudanese, whether you are in the position of power or not at the moment, who can say that South Sudan must be made up of different countries, all of them subscribe to the idea of South Sudan as a unified nation. The problem is, within the unified nation, how is it governed? So to answer the question, I think South Sudan could do well by figuring out whether ethnic federalism is something that they can do. It has been done in Ethiopia, and it has solved many problems. It didn't solve every problem, but it has solved many problems. So perhaps a centralized, strong state based in the capital city is not the way to go. It is important to have a national government, but at the same time, federalism, perhaps based on ethnic redrawing of state lines, is something that South Sudanese should try to make sure that all the different states, if there is a way for each ethnic group to have their own state, it should be tried. Because at the moment, there is really no crystal ball that will tell us how a multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multilinguistic African country should be managed, because there are no user's manuals here. You have to keep trying. And since we have tried a centralized government in South Sudan for the last 8 years, perhaps it is time for the leaders and the public of South Sudan to argue for a more and stronger federal system, perhaps along ethnic boundaries.
Thanks for that call, Gene. And Joke, tell us a little bit how the government of South Sudan is organized.
So South Sudan is a decentralized government. So you have a central government based in Juba, and then you have 10 states with governors and their cabinets and parliaments and their own judiciary. So it's almost like a federal system. But it is not entirely federal because states don't have that much independence when it comes to making decisions and passing laws for their own territories. They are still at the mercy of the central government, which is why a lot of people say either you go for one centralized government or you go for federalism. But when you go in for this mix, that doesn't give enough power to the people, but also gives the central government authority to explain away its failures by saying, but I have disbursed power to the states, I think that middle way does not work. And so perhaps a stronger federal system can quell some of these ethnic hatreds. Because at the end of the day, it is really a feeling among certain ethnic groups that their rights are subsumed under the dictatorship of majority ethnic groups.
And we are going to continue talking with Jok Madu Jok about the crisis in South Sudan, and we would encourage you to join in with your questions and comments. 1-800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@wpr.org or post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. And Judith in Hixton is up next. Let's go there. Hi, Judith.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Professor, my question is, I had the opportunity to work as a vocational counselor about 10 to 15 years ago, and I worked with a number of boys that had immigrated, and at the time, they were referred to as lost boys. Many of these young men left South Sudan when they were perhaps 8, 10 years old and lived in refugee camps for sometimes over a decade. So when I worked with them, they were in their early 20s, and they were working on vocational skills, obtaining a high school equivalency diploma. Many wanted to go on to higher education. But at that time, it was extremely emotional because many of them assumed they would never return home. They didn't know the status of their families. So I'm wondering if you could comment on what would happen, where they're at now that these young men are probably in their 30s, right, and perhaps some of them would want to return. So that's my question. If you could comment on that group of boys that immigrated called the Lost Boys.
Okay.
And I can take the comments off the air.
Great. Thank you, Judith. Joke?
Thank you. Yes. Well, the group of these young men called the Lost Boys of Sudan, it started out in the middle of 1980s, at age 7, 8, 10, to trek to Ethiopia to join what had become known as Sudan People's Liberation Army, which was a South Sudanese-based opposition that was trying to change the dynamics of power and governance in Sudan. When they arrived in Ethiopia, they had hoped that they would be able to go to school. But then in 1991, Ethiopia broke up when the former dictator there was overthrown. And they had to flee again back to Sudan. They were attacked. So many of them got eaten by wild animals. A lot of them drowned in many of the rivers they crossed. And they ended up in refugee camps all across the region, particularly the one in northern Kenya called Kakuma. And it is from there that the United States government and the UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, worked together to, there was about 100,000 of these young men. But by the time they were in Kakuma, there was only 20,000 of them. The U.S. government relocated and resettled about 4,000 of them in the U.S. and were given to, they were in the hands of many foster homes all across the country here in the United States. They did very well for themselves, surprisingly well, given the treacherous history they had gone through. Many of them graduated college, got master's degrees, PhDs, and a lot of them have been going back since 2011 when South Sudan became independent to try to help that country rebuilt itself. And many, many tragic stories has come from this return over the last month. One young man whose story was chronicled today in the Daily Nation, in the nation here in the United States, who had gone back after getting his master's degree to build a clinic and try to help people in his state of Yongle, which was an epicenter of the current conflict. And he escaped by grace of God, very, very close call for him. And for them to have gone through so much and to have worked so hard in order for them to eventually return to South Sudan and help it rebuild itself so that no more children can go through, have to go through what they went through, and yet the situation was not calm and they had to go through this once again was heartbreaking for many of us who have watched their lives over the years. But there is still hope. All of them are still quite hopeful that this situation in South Sudan right now is not going to last forever. There will be a solution to it, and they will all want to go back at some point to give whatever, whether they move back permanently or they visit there or create. Many of them have founded schools. I myself founded a school in my village. Many others have done the same, clinics and colleges. And schools have been established by these lost boys. Remarkable group of people, indeed. And so they are a resource for South Sudan. If only the leaders of South Sudan knew how to utilize their resilience and their foresight and their dedication to their country beyond oneself, they would benefit from them a great deal.
We are talking about the crisis in South Sudan. It's the world's newest country. And we are talking with Professor Jok Madujok. He teaches in the Department of History at Loyola Marymount University in California. He's a native of South Sudan and a co-founder of the think tank, the Sud Institute. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we are talking with Jok Madujok. He's professor in the Department of History at Loyola Marymount University in California and a native of South Sudan. He's also co-founder of the think tank, the Sud Institute. And we are talking about the crisis in South Sudan and would welcome your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Now, Jok, as we've been talking about, we've laid a lot of groundwork because there just is not that much known in the West and in the United States about the situation in South Sudan and the particular characteristics of that country. In December of last year, so just about a month ago, there was a big crisis that became a problem throughout the country. There were ethnic clashes. There were very violent clashes. What precipitated? We've talked about many different issues that have been percolating in the 2 years since independence. But what kind of sparked the tinder in December that there was this big crisis?
Okay, several things happened in December. One, the most ubiquitous, is that the ruling party, Sudan People's Liberation Movement, has been having serious tensions within it between the president, the chairman of the party, who is also the head of the executive, and a number of high-ranking officials within that party, including the former vice president. In July of this year, the president dissolved his entire cabinet and fired his vice president and 29 ministers, and then reappointed different people, only reappointing just very few. And he also dissolved some of the structures of the party, including the political bureau and the National Liberation Council. And this angered those prominent members of the SPLM who had been in the movement since its start. And so they began to criticize the government and the president for his quote-unquote undemocratic tendencies. this is what has built up to the point where disagreements became violent. The second issue is that there is a battalion of the Sudan People's Liberation Army, the country's defense force, and within it there is a battalion called the Presidential Guard, or Division 8. There were some disagreements in that division, and fighting broke out, and it quickly escalated and spread to other units and to other states within the next 2 to 3 days. There were also many, many issues that we have touched upon that are related to this crisis, and that include the exclusion of young people from the gains of independence, the lack of justice and accountability for terrible issues that were done in the liberation war. So there was no reconciliation, there was no justice, there was no healing for things that were done in that period. And also, so then you can say it is a power struggle within the current government that went out of control and became violent. So on December 15th, the last day of the meeting of the National Liberation Council, the sect leaders began to organize themselves to stage perhaps more civil exercise of disobedience in order to depose the president. And the president reacted in a way that did not help the situation, and the fighting broke out on the night of Sunday, December 15th, and would continue within Juba for the next 3 days. And then it escalated and spread to other countries, very quickly taking on ethnic lines, where the Dinka, which is the biggest ethnic group mm-hmm. where the president comes from, and the Nuer, the second biggest, where the vice president comes from, turned this political debate into a Nuer-Dinka military confrontation. Why it happened that way and how it is going to be resolved are still issues that are being debated. The problem is that the president and the vice president and all the other political leaders have now reduced this into a power politics, into a competition for public office, whereas the majority of the ordinary people are simply saying, we need this fighting to stop so that there is no more death. And then you can settle your own political problems in a negotiated settlement mediated by other countries, such as what is going on now in Ethiopia, being mediated by Intergovernmental Agency for Development, which is an East African grouping involving mm-hmm. many countries. And they have mediated now a ceasefire. So there is a ceasefire and there is a relative calm that has returned. But any settlement of such a situation must not just focus on returning to the status quo. It must be a comprehensive settlement that addresses all of these root causes that I have narrated, so that in the future the country can avoid plunging back into a chaotic situation as we are seeing today. Already 10,000 people have died, which is an extremely huge number given the short time mm-hmm. During which they have died. 500,000 people have been displaced from their homes and are now needing immediate humanitarian assistance. For South Sudan to return to such circumstances, slightly over 2 years since independence, is heartbreaking for most people in South Sudan.
You wrote that the clashes reveal ethnic double standards and hypocrisy. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes. You will find the debates that take ethnic lines involving people who are, on the one hand, are calling for unity of South Sudan, but on the other hand, are going out using this inflammatory ethnic language. On both sides, Nuer and Dinka, both of them use this very seriously deadly language of resolving their problems through the barrel of the gun. But at the same time, they are hoping to get a united, stable, prosperous South Sudan. That doesn't make sense. And you will find that there are not a lot of people who are pushing the envelope of peace. And South Sudan reveal their true colors of being extremely loyal to their ethnic groups rather than loyalty to their nation. And that is the double standard that is killing the many people in South Sudan today. And unless some brave people stand up on both sides and say, enough is enough, let us end this conflict and try to pursue the resolution of our problems through peaceful means, I think the situation will not return to calm anytime soon.
We're talking with Jok Madujok. He is professor in the Department of History at Loyola Marymount University in California. He's a native of South Sudan and a co-founder of the think tank, the Sud Institute. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn. Let's go to the phones and Nancy in Madison. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. A second question occurred to me as I was listening to the things the guest said most recently. I'll tell you, I traveled three times through Sudan in the 1960s between Uganda and Khartoum, and twice by road, and once on the Nile ferry. As I recall, maybe about 3 days of the out of the 6 day Nile trip were spent moving through the enormous marshy area called the Sud. And I wondered, I haven't heard any mention of the Sud in recent months, and would wonder if you would comment on what's on the on its role in the development and developing infrastructure and such in Sudan.
Thank you, Nancy. Go ahead, Jok.
Yes, there is indeed a lot to be learned from the history of other African countries that South Sudan could emulate. The other African countries have certainly gone through some of these challenging moments of how to deal with their ethnic diversity. The defining moment for Africa is seen in South Africa, where people who have gone through treacherous history and suffered a great deal were able to rise over the emotions and take to reason to say, history has happened, we cannot deny it, but must we go continue on the same route, we can change things. Countries like Kenya in 2007 went through violent episode following the general elections, and yet within a very short time they were able to rise above the differences in the interest of the country. Even Sudan, the country from which South Sudan seceded, they have shown a great deal of focus now on resolving the remaining problems within their territory. Uganda, south of South Sudan, have also gone through very, very tough times with the Lord's Resistance Army in northern Uganda, and they are all now finding ways to resolve this. So there is no question that South Sudan will one day rise above all of this, but it takes leadership, it takes foresight, it takes for commitment to peace in order for these diverse groups to feel that they have a stake in the nation.
And Nancy asked about the Sud Marsh area, and my understanding is that that area of the White Nile is populated by Dinka, by Nuer, and by Shaluk. Are there clashes happening in places like the Sud area because of what's going on in the capital?
Yes, indeed. That's where most of the fighting is taking place. The three states of South Sudan, Jonglei, Upper Nile, Unity State, and parts of Warap State, parts of Lake State, are all the states that straddle the Sud region, a vast territory And so that is basically where the two main ethnic groups that I've just told you, the Dinka and the Nuer, that's mm-hmm. where they reside. They are cattle people. And so that is exactly where the current crisis is concentrated, in some towns and villages in that region. It's really not the first time that the people who live there have confrontation. They have always competed over grazing. They have always competed over cattle. But they have always had their capacity within the cultural context that they live in to resolve some of these issues from time to time. What has made it difficult for them now to resolve their differences, as they have always done through their cultural mechanisms of reconciliation, is the involvement of the state and the involvement of firearms. In the state of the ways they used to fight, they had ethos. The Dinka and the Nuer had basic war ethos that they had followed, such as not attacking women and children, not burning villages. But these things have now become fair game under the weight of state control and because of firearms. Hmm. It's become extremely difficult to resolve traditional conflicts in the context of a modern state.
And actually, Joke, we just have a few minutes, and I want to make sure that we talk about one of the proposed resolutions. Recently, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Hank Cohen suggested that South Sudan be put into a U.N. trusteeship. I'm wondering what the response in South Sudan has been to that.
The response has been mixed. Majority of people think that it is an insult to argue that a sovereign country should be taken and replaced in the hands of a foreign entity, whether it is a UN or a group of countries. What I think myself is that there should be a degree of joint oversight between certain international actors and South Sudanese over specific institutions. It is not handing the country wholesale over to a foreign entity, but a kind of joint oversight of institutions such as the judiciary, so that the constitution is done right, so that the atrocities that have now occurred are sufficiently investigated in a fair climate. Another institution might be financial institutions, so that the corruption that has characterized the way things are done in South Sudan does not lead to siphoning of national resources to foreign countries, as has been done over the last 8 years. The police and the creation of the military should be overseen by a joint effort, so that these institutions, which are so crucial to security, reflect the national diversity of the country.
And in that diversity, Joke, do you think that the non-majority groups, the people that belong to tribes that are not the Dinka or the Nuer and are not affiliated with either the government directly or with the opposition right now, will they also have a seat at the table for moving South Sudan forward?
Well, that is really what is being demanded as the only way to have a more sustainable, more lasting peace, is to widen the negotiations, both in terms of issues being discussed as well as the representation of the various sectors of South Sudanese society. Narrowing the discussions to the political leaders alone will simply be a way to defer conflict, because the issues concerning the ordinary folks would not be addressed, as the leaders will simply focus on dividing power and the resources that come with it, and they will not address the various challenges.
Well, Joke, there's so much to cover here, but unfortunately we are out of time. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a good day, ma'am.
Joke Madujoke is a professor in the Department of History at Loyola Marymount University in California. He's a native of South Sudan and a co-founder of the think tank, the Sud Institute. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn today. At this time tomorrow, we will look at the cult of overwork. I hope you'll join us then.